Of Mickey Mantle, the ball player, Casey Stengel once said, "This kid ain't logical. He's too good. It's very confusing." At his best, Mantle stunned even his teammates with his prowess, and at his worst, he was an embarrassment to himself, his family, his friends, and his fans. In The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, author Jane Levy maintains that Mantle as a phenomenon transcended both extremes. She joins me now from NPR in Washington. Jane Levy, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, I can't imagine any place I'd rather be.
Oh, that's very nice. Your story of Mickey Mantle's life is arranged around several accounts of a particular meeting you had with him, and this is a meeting during which he passed out in your lap. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, you have to add the salient words, face down, in my lap to get the full view of it.
I thought I'd let you do that.
Well, you know, as many tragic elements as there are to this story, that was a surreal and, in retrospect anyway, funny moment, because after all, here I found myself stuck beneath 200 pounds of grade A American hero, passed out, dead drunk, face down in my lap. I could hear the bells and whistles of the casino. It was the Claridge Hotel and Casino by that point, where he had signed on as a greeter. And the room was swirling the way the lemons would downstairs. And all I could think of is, how did Mickey Mantle end up face down in my lap? And that was the story, basically, that I set out to tell. Because when I went to Atlantic City in 83 as a reporter for the Washington Post, I couldn't write what really happened. Mm-hmm. It would have been a firing offense in 1983 to write this story. Today, Bill, it would be a firing offense not to write it.
You posit that much of what was self-destructive about Mickey Mantle can be traced to his childhood. How so?
Well, he grew up in an area called the Tri-State Mining District, Commerce, Oklahoma. It's a barren, horrid landscape, one where fatalism percolates up from the earth. It is literally undermined. People there are quite accustomed to the world collapsing beneath their feet because so much had been taken out of the ground. So Mickey came by that sense of fatality, honestly. And on top of that, there was alcoholism embedded in his DNA from his mother's side of the family, one of his aunts. There was also sexual abuse that he suffered, first at the hands of his half-older sister. And that's something that Merlin Mantle, Mickey's wife, first discussed in a family memoir published a year after Mickey died in 1996. And he was not only abused by his half-older sister, but he had the experience that I presume lots of boys have of being chased down and fondled by neighborhood boys. He also had a sexual relationship with a high school English teacher. He said, "That's the only way I got through high school, was by screwing the teachers." So, you know, every boundary was crossed. And it became palpable to me that it could well explain why he crossed so many boundaries of taste and decorum. And it certainly explained to Merlin his promiscuity, his taste in women, she said, his language and his treatment of women. And it also explained to her how one can be the center of attention, the center of New York, when New York was the center of the world in baseball and everything else, and still feel acutely isolated and alone.
Many of the stories that demonstrate how great a ballplayer Mickey Mantle was emphasize his power at the plate. Have you a favorite among his home run stories?
Well, I for sure the chapter about the tape measure home run. That has to be my favorite because, of course, it's integral to the creation of the myth of the Mick. And what happened was that Chuck Stobbs, a lefty for the Senators, threw him a ball. He wailed into it, and he hit it over the 32 rows of concrete bleachers in left field at Griffith Stadium. And that ball's had gone out of the ballpark before off Ruth's bat and Dobie's, but only to right and right center field, not as far. Well, the ball kicked off the edge of a scoreboard and disappeared into the neighborhood, an area called LaDroite Park. And Red Patterson, according to legend, perpetuated largely by himself, stood up and said, "That one's got to be measured," and charged off after the ball. And when he returned with a tattered baseball, he also came back with a tail. And what he said was that he met a young boy named Donald Dunaway, who took him to the spot at 434 Oakdale Place, and he gave him the ball in exchange for, depending on which paper you read the next morning, 75 cents, a dollar, $5, $10. And Red returned with this and the miraculous number 565. Well, it took me 3 years, Bill, but I found Donald Dunaway. I had to hire two private eyes to find him, including a guy who's an FBI profiler who found Karzai in Pakistan after 5 years. And he told me this guy's harder to find than Karzai. He lived 2 miles from where the stadium used to stand, and he told me the story from his point of view. He never took anybody anywhere. He said, I never gave them the address 434 Oakdale Place. I just said it landed behind one of those houses on Fifth Street.
Yogi Berra's wife, Carmen, told you that even at the top of his game, Mickey Mantle was a danger to himself and, quote, he loathed himself. Does that strike you as overstatement?
No, no, it really doesn't. Sadly, I wish it were overstatement. I think that he was powerless to stop himself from his most self-destructive tendencies. It was a liquid time in America. Everybody had won for the road, if not four. I've wondered, Bill, recently, if there had been smartphones at the Copacabana and people had documented and posted on YouTube within seconds the shenanigans that went down in what was lovingly called the fracas at the Copa, would Mickey Mantle have been better off? If Mickey's recklessness, the kind of stuff that has in recent days and weeks and months caught up with Tiger Woods and Brett Favre and God knows how many athletes, if there had been a check and balance in technology, would he have been forced to come to grips with some of these things earlier? I think that's possible.
I'm speaking with Jane Levy, the author of The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, and you're listening to Only a Game. The standard evaluation of Mickey Mantle has always been, had he not torn up his knee at the very beginning of his career, or had he paid attention to rehabilitating himself instead of spending so much time in places like the Copacabana and other bars, he would have been even better. But you quote one of Mantle's teammates, Cleet Boyer, as saying, how much better could he have been? It's a great question, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an impossible question to answer. He had what we call the unhappy triad. He blew out his knee, ACL, MCL, torn cartilage, and he didn't have surgery until 2 years later. Even by playing, he was making it worse. So, yeah, he should have rehabbed better. Sure, he should have taken better care of himself in so many ways. But it wasn't all willful neglect that caused this. And the other thing that's true, and I really wanted to focus on the Willie, Mickey, and the Duke debate because it occupied so much of my childhood, mm-hmm. my dad being a Willie guy who grew up on Coogan's Bluff and who tormented me with a daily box score. You know, when you take all the new stats, all those fancy morps and warps and vorps, and when you measure Mantle retroactively, he does extraordinarily well.
Toward the end of his life, Mickey Mantle found sobriety, and one of the doctors who treated him during his rehab said that he had displayed a syndrome called, I'm quoting now, acquired situational narcissism. Is it fair to say that the high esteem in which he was held by his fans played a big part in Mantle's narcissism and ultimately his self-destruction?
I think it is, and I think it pertains to celebrities across the board. You know, Phil Lynn said to me a great thing. He said he watched Mickey in the locker room at Yankee Stadium. Phil was, of course, a rookie infielder with the Yankees in 62. And he said he watched the way the other players talked to him, what he called the loneliness of greatness. You're so isolated. All people want is to tell you about the time they saw you hit the ball off the right field facade. They don't ask, how are you? They don't really want to know, who are you? They know who they want you to be. And Phil said, you know, after watching that, he didn't want to be great.
Jane Levy is the author of The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood. The book is published by HarperCollins, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, I will come back and talk to you anywhere, anytime.
I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
You know who, the fellow with the celebrated swing. Oh, I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com. This is NPR.
The red swimming trunks worn by members of the Singapore men's water polo team at the Asian Games feature the white crescent moon of the country's flag. Given how skimpy racing bathing suits are, I mean, where was that moon bound to rise? Perhaps the designers of the uniform should have anticipated a problem, but they didn't. As a result, the suits have been characterized as nauseating and disgraceful by readers of Singapore's Straits Times. Since the rules state that athletes must compete in the uniforms presented at the start of the competition, the water polo players are stuck with what they've got, though the head of public relations has said the trunks design, quote, would be tweaked when the team returns home, presumably after the athletes take them off.